Thanks so much for coming. It must be 20 years ago since I would have been writing the book 20 years ago, for certain. Yes, I would have been well advanced, I think. I went last night to the text publishing party, which is part of the Melbourne Writers Festival, which is where I'm off to after this. And they were talking about it being their 20th anniversary next year, and Bear Brass was originally meant to be one of text publishing's first books, but they fell in on very early hard financial times and sold all their contracts to another publisher, and I was sold to someone else at that early stage, and so missed out on the glory of being one of text's first publications. But there you go. So yeah, 20 years ago, and I wasn't that young. I mean, I was 35 when Bear Brass was published, so you know, that's not so young. But I was a clean skin, which you were kind of alluding to without saying it. How did it come about? I'm thinking back. I grew up in a place which I always say had no history, and of course I know that's not true, and there may be people from Doncaster here. but I grew up in Doncaster, and if it wasn't a place that had no history, it was at least a place where one was not encouraged to have any awareness of the past, of what had happened in the past. It was a forward-looking place. This was the 60s. The orchards were being grown over with brick veneers, one of which I lived in. And, you know, history was passing away at a furious rate. So we were not encouraged in any way to look back, but only to look forward to the splendours of shopping town and and car yards all along Doncaster Road. Yeah, so I grew up in that place that had no history. And not only that, I can't look back now. The place has no history for me now. My house has been demolished. My school has been demolished. All my friends' houses have been demolished. It's still the same. It still just powers on. I went out to, you know, weep over what wasn't there just a few weeks ago. And, you know, couldn't work myself up to tears, I've got to say. But that's where I came from, with absolutely no historical dimension to my life whatsoever. And when I moved into the inner city, as you do as a 19-year-old, I guess, I was powerfully struck by the age of places around me and how different they were from Doncaster and how they'd clearly been there a long time. And almost immediately that gave rise to questions, or at least really one question for me, and that was, you know, what's their history? And more than that, what was here before? It was a question I'd never asked in Doncaster, where everything that was here before had gone. But here I started walking around and thinking about the history of places, and then realising, probably at the end of the 80s, towards the end of the 80s, realising here was all this Victorian history, and I educated myself about how, you know, the prosperity of later Victorian times, but I started to ask the question of where is the earlier Melbourne? Once I became aware of Melbourne's settlement starting in 1835, I asked those questions. What was here before? And I don't drive, so I was always walking around the streets, looking at things and kind of peering at almost what was underneath them, trying to figure out what their prehistory was, if you like. And that gave rise, you know, that's really what gave rise to this. But more immediately, what gave rise to it was moving to Hobart for a year or two in the late 80s. And I don't know, when you step off the plane, boat, whatever, in Tasmania, immediately you're made aware by Tasmanians that the place has a history, that they are powerfully engaged with it, and they know what it means to be Tasmanian. And I, coming from Victoria and Doncaster, what's more, realised I had no idea of what it meant to be Victorian. Certainly didn't have their powerful engagement with history. And living down there, I worked at the University of Tasmania for a year or so and used to spend my lunch times in the university library reading books about early Melbourne. So it was homesickness, working together in an alchemical sort of way with that historical awareness that's just palpable in Hobart and in Tasmania generally. So those are some of the things that went to work on my imagination and worked towards this. So this was the late 80s. In 1991, we came back. I lived in Castlemaine, where we moved to Castlemaine, where I still live, and I had my daughter was born, and I was 31, and I had that sense of being a stranger in one's own life for a year or two, as many mothers, particularly, you know, once they get into their 30s, as many first-time mothers have, of being dispossessed of one's own life. So the book, you know, really grew out of that. I've got to make my marks. I've got to remind myself, as well as anybody else, that I still exist. And so that was how I started writing the book. I took my curiosity, I took the interest that I already had, and my that sense of dispossession, and also being at a distance from Melbourne still. So although I could get the train and come here and walk around the streets and ask those questions in a more meaningful way, there was still that homesickness there that is a powerful fuel to writing, I think, about a place, just being at a remove from it. So those are the things that fueled the writing of Bear Brass and actually made it happen. Up until that time, I'd been a person who used to daydream about doing things. I suppose I was a young person, really. I used to daydream about doing things and not feel any real drive to do them. So, you know, turning the quarter into my 30s pushed me on to do it. But like I say, it grew out of that question, what was here before? And, you know, I couldn't imagine I was the only person who wondered that. And, of course, I was right. Lots of people did wonder that same thing, it turned out. And to this day, and it's the great thing, it's what I set out intending to do, to have people react this way, saying, people still say to me, since I read your book, I've never seen Melbourne the same way. And these will be people in the country who arrive like me at Spencer Street and walk through the western end of Melbourne, which is a bit of a wasteland, and they see it as the origins of Melbourne proper and can see the city beneath the city that's not there anymore. But to carry that historical awareness, that picture in your head of what was there before, and really build on it in an imaginative way, as everybody does once they have the germ of knowing and of wondering, is the thing I love about history and have built on through the writing of Bear Brass, through reading more, and through going on to write books like City Lost and Found about Wheel and the Wreckers Melbourne. So I've really seen through that the rise and fall and rise again of Melbourne and its buildings and its landscape. And that just, you know, it lives in here. And it's such a fabulous thing not to have a library of books that I need to leaf through to be reminded of that. It's just, it's in here. I can see those buildings, those four corner buildings at the corner of Burke and Queen Street that Whelan's pulled down in the same season of 1960. And I can stand at that corner while I'm waiting at the lights and look up and still see them there. Not that there was anything particularly interesting about them, but it's the knowing that counts, and it makes life more interesting. And that's what I aim to do for the readers of my books, is to make life in the city more interesting. Andrew is looking like he's got a question on his lips.
Can we have a bit of a conversation
about
it? Because when you started doing it, the first thing that grabbed you that said, this makes Melbourne come alive to me, you're obviously not reading other people's books so much, but you've gone to original sources. What's the first ones that really grabbed you?
Well, because I was at a distance from Melbourne, so I was in Hobart, for instance, or I was in Castlemaine, I wasn't reading primary sources at that stage. Well, they were published primary sources. Mm. So I was, when I was sitting up in bed after my daughter was born, the very afternoon, in fact, I had from Castlemaine Library a copy of the Historical Records of Victoria, volume, is it 3?
Yeah.
Early development of Melbourne, and I was reading through that. So things like that, dry as it may sound, were the things that fired my imagination, because there were voices of people here and involved in giving shape to the place in the earliest days.
But of course they're not dry as soon as you start to put yourself back into their shoes. And what about Edmund Finn and Gary Owen?
Absolutely.
The Chronicles of Early Melbourne,
yeah.
All Tales and True from the legendary past.
Sure, I mean, he was a beautiful contrast to the Historical Records of Victoria, yes, because you knew that his stories were marinated and many times told by the time he put them down on paper.
And he's got the art of the storyteller, which is, so this is where I'm interested to explore with you, because you're saying, I want to tell this story in a way that's somehow going to be maybe not consciously different to the way other historians were doing it, but saying I want to recapture something of that Gary Owen excitement, but still tell you things that I think are correct and true stories.
Yeah, look, I was listening to Miles before speaking and talking about things like scientific subjectivity. I think he mentioned subjectivity and scientific in the same sentence, which was interesting. But also rigorousness and so on. I haven't been to university. I had none of that with me, which I'm grateful for because I feel it was something I didn't have to unlearn. But so I didn't come to it thinking this has got to be correct. I've got to honour my sources. I really didn't, and I didn't know then what I didn't know. I have much more of a sense now of what I didn't know and what I don't know. But at that stage, I didn't. I really just wanted to share my enthusiasm and tell the stories very much in the spirit, as you say, of Gary Owen and the sense of character that comes through, that comes through in his writings. So I wanted to convey some of that and really connect people of those times powerfully with places, because place, putting people in the picture of a particular place really carries a strong sting for me, and I hoped it would do the same for readers.
And you're singing the baby to bed with volume 3 of Historical Records, which sort of could give new ideas for children's writers.
Possibly.
The other thing that really has changed since 1995, if you were now, you'd probably have the baby and you'd be up in bed with your laptop, getting into Trove and other original sources. So that is, to me, a huge change between the way you wrote that, conceived that book in 1995. Is it possible to write that side of book now because there's too much information?
Exactly. I'm with you, Andrew. I think that's true. It's a bit confounding approaching research and writing now because there seems to be no end to how much you might find out from your hospital bed. And then there was, there were huge gullies and gulfs and gaps between your sources that were readily accessible, and they gave play to your imagination in ways that, now you think, I wonder. They gave play to wondering. So a lot of what's in here is me wondering what it was like and speculating, whereas there's not so much room for speculation now. When you go, I wonder, and you've got the iPad there and you put it into Google and you don't have to wonder anymore because, hey, there's the answer. And the stifling of that wondering and wonderment would make a big difference to this, and it would also make a big difference to my being able to draw such clear boundaries around what I was doing and saying I'm going to research for 6 months and then I'm going to write for 6 months and that is it, because again, it feels like there's no end to researching when you're online. It can just go on forever. You can't shut it down in the same way.
There's a terrific book about the exploration of inland, which I have on my bookshelf, which is a quote from Sturt. I think I see no end to travelling.
It's just like that.
You've got those open plains there, and I think it is an important discipline to
no end to stop.
So then the response to the book, because the book was very well received by general readers, and what did historians have to say about it? Did they ignore you? Did they give you a hard time? Did they pretend it wasn't happening and that their books were going to do better than yours? what was the response to the book?
I probably wasn't all that aware of it because I didn't mix in those kinds of circles, I suppose. As time went by, I was aware of some sense of disapproval of the way I went about things, and that was part of the beginning of my understanding how much I didn't know, which has made subsequent projects more difficult for me, because knowing how much you don't know is never a good place to start. Well, it can be. I only had a vague sense of that, and because it wasn't my world, because I wasn't of the scholarly world and had no real kind of investment in it, I could be pretty blissfully unaware of that.
So before you got onto reading Historical Records, what was you reading when you were a child, and what sort of stories and influences were coming in our deepest Doncaster? What were you getting out of the library?
I don't know. It didn't have a lot of books. I mean, we did have a library. I don't know. I don't know what I was reading. I just read all the normal pap that a young person and a teenager reads, and it was with, as with lots of young people, it was leaving school coming into the inner city and then travelling overseas a little to Europe, that again gave me that sense of history and of things being older than me and beginning to ask questions. So it was, you know, it was my reading from there on through my 20s gave rise, it was a lot more historical and factual and fed my interest in such things as this. So it really came out of, it came organically, just out of observing and wondering and asking questions.
And I think a lot of us find that that history often brings up characters and stories that, that fiction can't really do justice.
It can't satisfy.
To. And interesting with the somebody like Kate Grenfell and the Secret River and so on. In some ways, she was confronted, if you read her second book, about going back and doing the research and realising actually the history side of it's really, really difficult. But it's throwing up maybe stories that. That people wouldn't believe. What's your? This is always an unfair question to throw at you here, but in terms of the episode that you really enjoy going back and, I mean, you obviously like this is a well thumbed book. She's read it a few times, so you obviously enjoy going back occasionally and saying, "I like that story. That was my favourite story." Was there any that jump out at you?
Actually, I've never reread the book. I mean, I did when I was, but I never reread anything I write. The things that had such a sense of fun for me, and they did very often come out of retellings by people like Gary Owen, but just about the mischief that people got up to. And I must admit, I love the stories about those young bucks from the Melbourne Club, because the Melbourne Club and the image of it now is so other than that. And to think about their origins and their Waterfordian ways gives me a great deal of pleasure. So a lot of the naughtiness that happened on the early streets of Melbourne, and that conveys to me also the youth of the people who were there. And it's the same with the gold rushes, the youth of the population, and the fact that they were a long way from home and their families came through very powerfully.
And so misbehave at a distance.
That's right,
and
yes.
Some of them were here because they've been misbehaving closer at home as well.
But, that's right.
But it is one of the problems of when you've got those pictures of the pioneers, the ancient pioneers with their grey beards and so on, you go back to that material and these are men and some women in their teens, in their 20s, getting positions of power and authority that they never could have had at home.
Yeah.
So on this Bex question, we'd started this conversation downstairs with Miles Lewis launching this book. and the conversation is really one about what people did when they were young and coming to these places, and that's something that I think a lot of people forget and don't realise the youth and the opportunities. And if you look at somebody like von Mueller, you know, the botanist, the amount of distance that he covered, and there are other mad botanists. So you look at the observatory across the road here. But what I was going to ask was that we talked about Melbourne Day as being a way of trying to put somewhere some neutral ground, as it were, between the biggest problem of Batman, Faulkner, and of course the Aboriginal occupation of this area, and that's become much more richly understood in recent times. But if you were having to umpire between Batman and Faulkner, let's give us an opinion about the two protagonists. How do they grab you?
Well, I think it comes through. I think it comes through fairly clearly in Bare Brass that I barrack for Johnny Faulkner, only because I mean he lived longer and gave people an opportunity to tell many more stories about him. He didn't make himself beloved by living longer, but. He got to blow his own trumpet a lot more and put his case more. I don't know how it obviously didn't do him any good, because once he was dead, you know, Batman was the man, seemed to be the man forevermore. But I'd go for Johnny Faulkner just because, you know, I just love the spirit of the man. I just love the spirit and the cheek of him, the utter cheek that he would...
There's this image of him, because I mean, Batman, and again with the revisionist in all of this, but the received version is that Batman dies of syphilis, but he's a strong outdoors rugged type, isn't he, Batman? And I mean, he was Batman before he was Batman.
Mm,
and, And so he's got that reputation, and then there's this question of, you know, whether or not he was right to try and negotiate with the Wurundjeri people. But with Faulkner, you've also got this image of, and it's in a couple of biographies it comes through, that you've got this small boy who's here in 1803.
Yes.
when that settlement, that,
yep.
Now, remind me, do you talk about 1803 in Bear Brass?
I do, and about how I feel that he came here feeling that he had a prior sense of connection and almost destiny. Now, I don't know if that's true, but you could see that in the kind of man that he was, that he might think that way, that he'd come here as the son of a come to these parts as the son of a convict and return triumphantly as a settler and as a pioneer and as a leader.
And you'd have that sense, as you might if you had your first holiday down on the Mornington Peninsula and you come back years later and you sort of think, I own this place,
yep.
And I'm just as, it's in my blood as much as anybody else's. And then, of course, he becomes newspaper man. Now, the idea of handwriting a newspaper, even Rupert Murdoch doesn't handwrite his newspaper. But that's an extraordinary story, isn't it, of him as publisher, as publican?
That's the spirit of the man that I'm talking about, that I so respond to. He's just so can-do, and, the morality of the man is very questionable to a modern person, and I think it was at the time. But just his enterprising spirit and his can-do spirit was just, it bowled me over, I've got to say. And I've been really impressed in recent times to read James Boyce's 1835 and to read his story of Batman and his, I was going to say his treaty, but his negotiations. And that nuanced story that's told by Boyce is so enriches Batman as a character and his motives and his actions that, it has shifted my thinking towards Batman a little more, having read that. So, you can always change your mind.
And it's 10 years since the second edition came out.
Coming
and is
up.
Is it a book? Is it too early to say it's a modern classic that we're going to look for further reprints, or is it one of those things where you think that served its turn? And
that's certainly how I feel about it. I don't see it going on being republished. It still sells along quietly, and the people in readings and some of the independent bookshops always have it there, and they consider it a kind of a modern classic because it's a book that's now nearly 20 years old and continues to sell. So from their point of view, it qualifies for that. And that's great. But I don't see it, going on being reprinted forever, especially with the publishing world the way it is.
Is it a book for outsiders, or do you have to actually have a bit of a understanding? Do you have to have got the Melbourne bug a little bit to really enjoy this? Or what about people coming here and seeing it for the first time? Have you had feedback from them?
Yeah, I think of it as a book for insiders, but I've certainly had people say to me they've sent it to relatives in Britain and so on, and they've enjoyed the story that it tells. So that's without any familiarity with Melbourne at all. So I guess there are people who enjoy the stories of how a place takes shape and is appropriated by people, and no matter where that story, that no matter where that place is. And I'm glad to think of that, because it annoys me sometimes that, for instance, you can't interest a publisher in Melbourne in publishing a book about, a neighbourhood or a suburb or something that in a big way, where if it's a suburb of London or a suburb of Paris or a part of New York, no problem. They know it will be sold the world over, and even people who've never been there will be engaged with it. So I'd love that idea to permeate, that I could write a book about, as I'd love to, about a particular neighbourhood of my town, Castlemaine, which I see as a real embodiment of how the gold rush settled down, of how the gold rush became a township. And I think there's a fabulous story there to tell, but publishers can't see finding an overseas market for it, which is the apex of what's required now.
And so you're trying to build up that, what you call that sort of mass that makes it possible to make those stories there. But I think it's happening in Melbourne, that there's the city's getting bigger, there's a new wave of people coming through, the curiosity people are going to even start asking about Doncaster. Even I ask a few, I drive through quite often, I ask questions about it myself, but so, you know, it could be happening. I mean, what happened to those? There was a row of palm trees that used to grow in the University of Melbourne in the 1960s, mm-hmm. which were transplanted on semi-trailers and taken to Doncaster shopping town.
Oh, yeah, I remember those. And were they? I didn't know
where
that.
Where are they now?
They've gone.
You know, there are stories there waiting to be explored. And I'd like if we do just have a few minutes, and I've monopolised the conversation, but there may be other people who might have a question to ask to you, Robin, about this. But while they're thinking about that, which question it is, I know somebody's out there thinking about a question, I'd like to ask you, which is your favourite demolished building out of all the ones that Wheel and the Wrecker wrecked? Which one do you really wish was still there?
It would have to be Coles Brook Arcade. I mean, if there's one place that I would love to walk through, that I do walk through in my dreams, it would be Coles Brook Arcade.
With EW Cole in it.
Yeah, preferably. Yeah. And Mrs. Cole. Holding court.
Yes.
Yeah. That would be the place. Although the building in itself was nothing. I mean, no, it was something special. But the building, it's what was in that building. There are other buildings which, in and of themselves, I wish I'd had the chance to visit.
But and part of what you're doing is challenging the orthodoxies, as I think all good writers do, say, look at this with slightly fresh eyes. And one of the orthodoxies we've had about Melbourne being a boring provincial town. Mm. I wrote about this in an article a while ago, and saying, well, yes, it's been completely reinvented in the last 10, 20, 30, 50 years, but of course in that gold rush period, what a cosmopolitan place it was, and what people coming with all these different ideas and the politics coinciding and colliding.
Yeah.
And I think you really bring that out in your book. So
selling that sense of possibility that made Melbourne, that people brought with them from wherever they were, that sense of reinventing not only themselves but really making a place in their own image, and that they, wherever they'd come from, it was possible for them to make a mark on the place. That's the story of 19th century Melbourne that I love to put out there.